Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkoff from Downey & Lenkoff. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Max Schazenbach is professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. Northwestern is one of those schools where the demonstrations have been taking place. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about why protesters' demands may be easier said than done. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, the Wall Street Journal op-ed that Ryan mentioned, you talk about that divestment from Israel may be actually a breach of a university's fiduciary duty and therefore a real peril legally. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so let's take two sort of separate functions within the university. I was speaking mainly to the management of the endowment. So when you agree as a fiduciary to manage a pool of assets for the benefit of a third party, or in the case of a charity or nonprofit, for the benefit of a charitable mission like education, you take on pretty strict fiduciary obligations of care and loyalty. You have to diversify the portfolio. You have to monitor it. You have to think about whether the risk you've taken on is appropriate in relation to the charitable mission. And then you have to act in the best interests of that charitable mission if you're a nonprofit corporation. If you're a charity, you have to actually act in the sole interest of that charitable mission. And so if you act for ancillary social causes or for your own ethical judgments, you are basically being disloyal and you're in breach of your fiduciary obligations. And so, and if you listen to third parties regarding their own non-financial judgments about the appropriateness of a typical investment, you're also in breach of your fiduciary obligation of loyalty because you're not focused on the charitable mission. The nit is that in the case of a charity, we understand that certain charities are going to have purposes that might conflict directly with an investment. And so, as I say in the op-ed, the Catholic Church doesn't have to invest its assets in pharmaceutical companies that make abortifacients. We understand the Sierra Club doesn't have to buy into Exxon and so forth, that they can actually divest from pretty significant swaths of an industry if it's directly contrary to their charitable mission. I don't see how Israel fits that category here, and some of the divestment demands are quite broad. There's a second sort of set of divestment demands that involve more like the management of the university, like what relationships the university has with other institutions and where we can go on conferences and that kind of thing. That's really a separate issue that's judged under a different standard, something probably more like the business judgment rule that we're more familiar with. The university will have a lot more leeway there. So I was speaking to the endowment issue.
So 14 states have laws banning public universities from boycotting Israel or from entering into contracts with companies that have anti-Israel policies. Mm-hmm. Could that be another reason why divestment isn't practical, at least in those states? Do you have any comments on that front?
Yes, well, that would certainly, you know, as I read those statutes, it would certainly constrain the public universities within those states because they're written quite broadly. But there's also layers to those statutes. So some of them actually prevent the universities or any state agency from sort of holding funds or investing in a business that has divested from Israel or has adopted a BDS, boycott, divest, sanction type position. And so as I understand it, in Illinois, the public pension funds cannot invest in a company that is divested from Israel. I assume that would apply to state university endowments as well. But then there's also a business side to some of those statutes, which say that you can't basically discriminate. It's almost like an anti-discrimination provision. You can't prohibit relationships with Israeli universities. You can't ban faculty from going to conferences in Israel and so forth. And so they apply, you know, pretty broadly. Those don't apply on their face to private institutions, though. But you know, to the extent that you're going to look to what's the charitable purpose of a university, if many states, including, you know, some pretty liberal states like New York and Illinois, have taken a really strong anti-BDS position, I think it's going to be really hard to make the claim that it's even, you know, a reasonable ancillary part of your educational mission such that you could skew the portfolio against Israel. And I should add that, you know, the neutrality position I sort of lay out, which is like a positive analysis. I'm trying to say this is basically what the law is. A portfolio manager at a university couldn't skew the portfolio in favor of Israel as well, or in favor of defense stocks because they think that it has serves an ethical or broader social purpose. So I'm really laying out a neutrality position. The BDS statutes seem to be pretty specific to Israel, but I think you could at least read them as requiring a neutrality position of at least these public institutions.
Professor, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court last year declined to hear a case discussing a ban, dealing with a ban to divest from Israel in Arkansas, the state of Arkansas, letting stand a lower court ruling upholding the law. Is that a likely outcome, again, if a divestment case makes its way up to that Supreme Court?
So I think putting this in the context of private institutions, they have really strong associational rights. And so I think if you had a private institution that could reasonably point to a charitable mission that really conflicted with arms manufacturers or Israeli firms, given what the Israeli government policy presently is, they probably could defend that. They may even have First Amendment rights in that area. On the other hand, I think that it seems unlikely that a private secular university can really credibly make that claim. And so imagine that there's like a Quaker university, right, that has a religious mission as well as an educational mission. I think they probably do get to divest from Israel on those grounds that it conflicts with their charitable mission. Maybe some Catholic schools could as well. And maybe you could even stretch it to say a school that has really pronounced progressive values. And I'm thinking of someplace like maybe the New School in New York that has a really pronounced progressive policy statement, even in their charitable mission statement. Maybe they can make that case, whether it's wise, whether it's effective as a matter of modern finance, when there's lots of money sloshing around and financial markets are deep and efficient in many of these contexts, you know, is another question. I think that's another layer of analysis that they should probably do on top of that. So I don't see it applying to private secular institutions. Some institutions where they really have these strong values maybe could make that case. You could also say maybe Yeshiva University could announce that they're going to skew their portfolio in favor of these firms. I think that's probably unwise policy as a matter of financial policy and what the purposes of the endowment are, but it may well be legally permissible if it's central to their purpose. But most universities, secular universities, they say we're about education and research, and it doesn't really go much beyond that. And so I think I find it very hard to believe that they could even make an associational claim. So just putting it on the table, if a state legislature decided to say, hey, if you're a private secular school, you have to manage your endowment in an for non-political reasons, for non-social reasons, just for solely for your charitable purpose, I think they could. I think that statute would pass muster. And we'd see if organizations tried to change their charitable purpose as a response to that. But I think that could be, I'm not recommending it, to be clear, because I think the law we have now is pretty good, frankly, if we follow it. But that is a possibility. So you could expand the BDS statutes to private institutions. And I think I would hope they would do it as a neutrality position, which is you can't take this political statement or a social statement with your endowment funds.
Professor, do you think demonstrations on college campuses are protected free speech, especially what we've been seeing on college campuses over the past few months?
Well, I'm not an expert at drawing the line between speech and conduct, but here's where it sort of does intersect with the endowment and the management of the university, right? So the universities are saying, like Columbia said, hey, we reached consensus around fossil fuels, so we divested from fossil fuels. I actually think consensus is irrelevant to the question of whether you should divest from fossil fuels. The charitable purpose is the mission of the university. That's what you have to invest for. Any constituents who currently are there, the students, the faculty, are not the only beneficiaries. There's future beneficiaries, there's alumni. And so you have to think, you really do have to think about the mission. And I do worry that in an attempt to sort of quiet the protests, the universities are, I think, responding to conduct that is pretty clearly impermissible in a hope to just get through the next couple of months and get through graduation. But what they're promising with the endowments, when push comes to shove, I mean, eventually the investment committee is going to have to meet. And they're going to have to say, hey, do we do what the protesters are wanting? What does divestment actually mean? They're going to get legal advice about whether or not they can do this. And, you know, I don't think at the end of the day, they're going to conclude that they can actually divest from Israel or even get close, maybe even do one thing the protesters are asking for. And we'll be back to square one because they'll be back to demanding divestment. And I would tell them, if I could speak to them, that their energies would be better addressed to the state legislatures or Congress regarding BDS. The idea that you're going to influence anything, you know, both as a matter of law, and then even if you could do it as a matter of just finance and ultimate effects, it's not a very effective approach. Go lobby for sanctions at the national level. Go change the state BDS laws if you can. But really, the university trustees should be left alone as regards this. The extent to which they have discretion about other relationships with Israeli universities and so forth is, I got to set to the side, because that is evaluated under a different standard. And there's a lot of discretion vested in the trustees in that regard.
Now, on top of all of this, it's the end of the school year, so it's crunch time for you. Professor, thanks so much. Enjoy it. Enjoy your summer.
Thanks for having me. Glad to talk.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. New York Appeals Court has tossed the rape conviction of Harvey Weinstein. The ruling is troubling a lot of people. Juliette Williams joins Legal Face-Off. She's a professor of gender studies at UCLA. Ms. Williams, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Professor, last month, Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction was overturned by a New York appeals court after finding that the trial judge handed down improper rulings in admitting testimony from women with allegations that were not a part of the case. Can you tell us more about the reasoning behind this ruling?
Sure. So, as you say, the appeals court tossed out the convictions, saying that the trial judge had erred in allowing testimony from witnesses pertaining to so-called bad acts or prior alleged crimes that were not within the purview of this decision. The three witnesses that the trial judge allowed to provide testimony were brought in as under an exception to standard rules of evidence. And in New York State, the standard rules of evidence include the so-called Molyneux rule, which established that, generally speaking, prior bad acts or prior patterns of behavior or a propensity to commit a crime, that evidence that speak to those issues should not be allowed. There are in New York all kinds of exceptions to the Molyneux rule, and the witnesses that the trial judge allowed in this case were brought in as exceptions. The appeals court has now held by a vote of 4-3 that allowing that exception was improper.
So is this new? Is this just an interpretation of existing case law, or are they making new case law? Because I know, it is fairly, it has been used before. We saw very famously in the Bill Cosby case, which is a different state, admittedly Pennsylvania, where, modus operandi witnesses were brought in, and that was allowed. And that was a big reason why, Cosby was initially convicted. And that's, a similar pattern here. So is this new case law, or is this simply an interpretation in this particular case that might not be precedential in other cases?
I think what we're seeing here, first of all, is the very unsettled state of the law, particularly in the area of sex crimes. So you're talking about the Cosby case, which took place in Pennsylvania. We know that Weinstein has been convicted not only in New York State, but in California. I'm not sure that people realize that the rules of evidence and of criminal procedure generally vary quite significantly across the country. Out of the work that activists in the hashtag MeToo movement have done, as well as longstanding efforts to address the problems within the criminal justice system in identifying perpetrators of sex crimes, there's an ongoing conversation about how to adjust rules of evidence to balance, on the one hand, the sacrosanct rights of the accused, but on the other, to ensure that we don't let a sense of procedure impede the actual delivery of justice, which is what we all want.
So, Professor, you mentioned, obviously, this case is in the context of the larger Me Too movement. How much of an impact do you think the procedural issues and this overturned conviction will have on the Me Too movement at large?
I think this decision is extremely important for the hashtag Me Too movement. Anyone can see that written into the name of the movement itself, Me Too, is a quite pointed indictment, not just of our society generally, but of our legal system specifically, in its demand that so many voices be raised before even a single person can get justice. Me Too is really a way of saying we all stand together, even though we've been rendered invisible within the justice system. The Weinstein decision, of course, is disappointing to many in the movement, because this case was taken as a symbol of the possibility of finally getting a fair hearing and a justice in the criminal justice system. But I think that one of the effects of this decision is going to be a reminder that what the movement wants isn't about one or two bad actors going to jail. That's not what a social movement is. The social movement is about continuing to demand reforms of the justice system so that everybody has a fair chance to have their case heard.
Professor, talk to us a little bit, if you can, about the effect on the victims that a decision like this has, who we know were very brave to come forward. It's very difficult to come forward when you're a victim of sexual abuse, sexual harassment, rape in many cases. So, they came forward very bravely. They told their story. They were attacked for doing so. They were cross-examined for doing so. They were very relieved with the conviction. And now, many years later, they have to now face this overturning in the face of overwhelming evidence. And we heard a lot of evidence in the Weinstein case, including his own voice on those tapes, where he invited one victim to watch him in the shower. So that's got to be very impactful on victims, again, who were brave enough to come forward in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, I think that this decision is very disheartening for everybody, because I think that people recognize the absolute importance of procedures and procedural justice and making sure that the rules are fair when anybody is put on trial. A decision like this reinforces the longstanding charge that we have a system in the United States where the procedures don't ensure fairness. The procedures effectively rig the system against justice. And when there is such a stark contrast between the evidence, and you know, nobody disputes that, not even the majority in this appeals court decision. When the evidence is so clear and the outcome diverges so far from that, that's disheartening to everyone. In addition, as you say, the ask of victims to have to repeat their trauma over and over and over again verges itself on a kind of re-victimization and needs to be addressed within our conception of what fair procedures mean. Fair procedures certainly for the accused, but you know, also we need fair procedures for victims.
Well, and Weinstein was actually in court today with as authorities. They're considering California's extradition request for a 2022 rape conviction in L.A. Thank you, Professor Juliet Williams, for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you so much for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Faceoff podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Tiffany Chappelle Ingram is executive director for the Cannabis Business Association of Illinois, which represents large licensed marijuana companies. She joins us on Legal Faceoff to chat about a possible ban on intoxicating hemp products. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ryan.
Tiffany, last month, Illinois lawmakers introduced proposed legislation that would effectively ban intoxicating hemp products such as Delta-8 THC. Tell us more about this proposed legislation and the rationale.
So CBAI introduced legislation that would provide some consumer clarity and some regulations in this space. What do I mean by that? So when the bill essentially does is that it creates a regulatory framework for consumer hemp products, which are your CBD products, your Charlotte's Webs of the world, your very low THC products that are really intended for therapeutics. So it creates sort of a bright line of what that is so that consumers can have confidence that that's the product that they are seeking, that that's the product that they get. What it also does is that it's saying like, hey, if you want to be in the sort of intoxicating space of having a high sort of THC cannabinoid, then that means that you belong in the state's pre-existing cannabis regulations under the cannabis regulation, the CRTA. So, you know, it creates that bright line. It also says that, hey, as far as these other intoxicants, if you will, that are being synthesized, that is something that needs, you know, further study. As you know, there has not been a great deal of study in this space. There are other cannabinoids that are being made, and we're in a space where these are completely unregulated. So consumers aren't knowing what they're consuming. They're not knowing if the ingredients actually match what's on the label. They're not even understanding if they're actually in a regulated dispensary versus an entity that's holding itself out to be a dispensary. And we just want clarity for that.
Tiffany, this week, purveyors and supporters of these products went to Springfield in Illinois, here where we are, the state capital. Tobacco bill sponsored by Westside State Representative LaShawn Ford with a proposal to regulate these products rather than outright banning them. What is this proposal and do you think it's enough?
So I want to acknowledge and appreciate the work that Representative Ford has been doing in the cannabis space. But with that said, we don't think that his legislation goes far enough. We think that the state has already spoken as far as creating a comprehensive cannabis program. And if you are in the market for creating intoxicants, we think that you should be under that. So that, I mean, that's what I would, you know, that's how I would respond. Their bill seeks to do sort of lesser extent of regulation, a lesser extent of all sorts of things that we don't think go far enough.
So Tiffany, there's conversation when we talk about all of this, there's conversation about the federal farm bill of 2018 that had legalized the sale of hemp derivatives, but had banned products with more than a modicum amount of Delta 9 THC, which is the component in weed that makes people high, but did not account for other psychoactive compounds such as Delta 8. How do you think the farm bill can be amended to address what have been framed as loopholes, particularly when it comes to protecting children, for example, and young adults from the risks that you've been profiling?
So thank you for bringing that up, Christina. So the farm bill, as it currently is, has created a loophole. But with that said, states have stepped in and and spoken about how they want these products to be treated in their market, right? And so what we're saying is hey, the General Assembly, the state of Illinois took great time and care to put some regulations in this space. And we think that they already exist. And so we're saying, hey, there's a structure that you exist where you can still continue to operate. That's something that should be codified. As you know, there's been rescheduling. And so that will change the landscape as far as research and a whole host of things. And so what we hope to see as the federal government goes down the road of deciding how it would treat cannabis and how it will, deal with the next iteration of the farm bill, we're hopeful that there will be a more normalization of cannabis products so that, there's more understanding. There's still a lot we don't know.
So I think Florida recently passed legislation that makes Delta 8 illegal in that state as of October 1st. What sort of unintended consequences can outright prohibition cause, in your opinion?
I think what I would say to that, Rick and Rich, and thank you for the question, is that, the unintended consequence that we're confronting now is that when I know of people personally who have gone into what they believe to be a dispensary, and it wasn't, and they got product and they weren't sure what it is. I have personally talked to parents whose kids have consumed this product and have had to go to poison control or the hospital. So I think the unintended consequences, what we're experiencing now, is that when you continue to have a space that's unregulated, it really causes harm and confusion to consumers. And that's not a help for anyone. And so, I think when, products are appropriately dealt with, then you can handle that. And we'll watch to see what happens in Florida, frankly. We'll watch like everyone else.
One of these Illinois bills floating around could fine businesses up to $10,000 and force them to give up their license if they don't follow good manufacturing practices. So we'll see how that turns out. Tiffany Chappelle Ingram, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We have the pleasure of being joined by David Sussler. He's the Associate General Counsel for National Material LP, a privately held, minority-owned manufacturing company operating throughout the U.S. and Mexico. Mr. Sussler, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Sam Penyanovich is a sports betting analyst for Fox Sports and NESN, former host of Legal Face-Off, and I believe he still owes some of us on this panel some Boston cannoli. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Well, Stormy Daniels is back on the stand today at Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York. This week, we learned another one of the former president's criminal trials, the one in Georgia, has been put on hold. Rich, where do you want to take the Trump watch today?
I mean, I think, first of all, shout out to our returning guests, the OGs, a couple of the OGs on the show. It feels like it's 2016 all over again. So good to see you fellas, as always. It was a good couple of days for Trump. I really think that Trump is going to win the only case that might be decided before the election, given what Stormy Daniels, how completely disastrous that was, I think, for the prosecution. Although today seems to be going pretty well. The cross-examination is meandering and it's not great. But I think the last couple of days of Stormy Daniels testifying was honestly a disaster for the case against Trump. And I say that, Tina, because, you know, it might be salacious. It might be interesting to hear all these details that, you know, they were engaged in a missionary position and he had Old Spice in the bathroom and what he said. But it's ridiculous. Like, none of that should have been heard. The judge even said at the end of the testimony from Stormy Daniels that he wishes she didn't say all that. And why? Because, you know, you're supposed to only allow relevant evidence, material evidence. None of that has really anything to do with the very simple question of whether Trump committed election fraud when he, you know, allegedly paid this former porn star hush money. I think the more you bring out, the more details you have of, again, we might not like Trump, you might not respect him, he's a former president. The more you bring out of his personal life and his sexual preferences, the more the jury is going to think, in my opinion, that this is just a joke. And this has nothing to do with this core question of whether he committed a crime. But I honestly think that it won't even get to a jury. I believe that it will be mistried fairly soon. And if not, I think the jury is going to look at this and say, what a terrible job the prosecutors did and let him walk, number one. Number two, he got another win, right? I mean, the Georgia appeal court allowed that issue of whether Fannie Willis should have been taken off the case to be on appeal. So the bottom line is none of these cases are going to go to trial before the election. The only one is the current case that's going on in New York. And that looks to me to be a win for Trump.
I mean, I'm not as optimistic in terms of Trump winning this case, but I agree with you. I definitely think that there's a noteworthy risk of the mistrial, which in that case, it is a win for Trump. And I agree with you. These other two cases are not going to be tried before the election. And so we have and it's interesting because a couple of weeks ago, I think a lot of people who are not pro-Trump, who are anti-Trump, were sort of dancing a jig in the hallway saying, you know, finally the time has come, you know, this is where he's going to get it. And, you know, that's just not how these things go. And so we have a real possibility here, especially with him being the front runner, of the real possibility of him being the president again come election time.
Yeah. And Sessler and Sam, I do think that it's such a close election that a victory by Trump in this case will be enough to influence that middle group of voters that are on the fence. It's only going to take really, honestly, a small group of voters to determine the election. I think this will do it. And honestly, I've been following the trial very closely, been analyzing it for, you know, a couple other broadcasts as well. And I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced that they've made their case. And here's the reason why. You know, again, you have to get the ultimate question is whether Trump intended to make this hush money payment to make it secret so that, you know, it would not affect the election. How are they ever going to prove that? Trump's not going to testify. Do they have to extrapolate this intent from two people? Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen's not going to be credible. They're going to go after him so hard that he's not credible. So, and Hope X didn't really do anything to hurt Trump. So, I don't know. I don't think the case is going too well. I don't know what you guys think.
Well, look, I don't like to try cases in the media. You can't try cases in the media. So I haven't been following him as closely as you have.
You're on the wrong show then, Sessler.
But no, you can't try cases, especially like this, in the media, because you don't get the evidence and you don't get the facts as it comes into the jury. I agree. I think maybe the prosecution went a little too far with eliciting these details from Stormy. But another way to look at it is it goes to Trump's credibility in alleging the affair never even happened in the first place. And that is a fact that is directly relevant to the heart of the case. And this case is about the integrity of business records under Illinois state, under New York state law. That's what it's about. So you know, I think it's premature to say, and I would be surprised if the judge granted a mistrial.
But don't you think, to your point, I mean, yes, in a normal case, if a witness lies, then they're cooked, right? But this is Trump. He lies about everything. There's not a single person on the jury or on this planet who thinks that this one lie is going to affect, like, what? Do you suddenly think that Trump's not a liar? And, oh, because he lied about this, he's not credible? He has no credibility. But that's what you get with Trump. That's part of the difficulty in prosecuting him is because he lies about everything. So why would this be any
different? It depends on if the jurors do their job. That's what it depends on. Will they do their job? The delay
still feels like, though, doesn't it feel like they've been trying to nail this fish to the wall for almost a decade and he just keeps slipping out of it? I don't think he's a good guy. I think most people feel that way, but it, without trying to make it political, doesn't it feel political? I mean, this is the only guy that could beat Joe Biden, and they keep dragging him over the coals and trying to get him on something. And let's say I have friend X and friend Y, and they're on different ends of the spectrum. Friend X says, they're finally going to get him. This is it. While friend Y is saying, if they don't get him, this is great for us. So it's a fascinating situation. And it's also embarrassing that these are the two candidates for president. But that's a different conversation for a different day, I guess.
Yep.
All right. More fallout from the pro-Palestinian college protests we've been seeing. Tina, there are federal judges who are now saying they won't hire anyone from Columbia University.
Yeah, Ryan. So I actually think this is yet another embarrassing situation. So earlier this week, 13 conservative federal judges announced that they would not hire law students from Columbia Law School in response to the university's handling of pro-Palestinian protests and calling the Manhattan campus an incubator of bigotry in a letter to the Columbia president and law school dean. Law school Dean Lester quickly responded the next day that the law school's graduates are consistently sought out by leading employers in the public and private sectors. And in fact, they actually don't have many of their folks who go for clerkships, so it may be much ado about nothing. The lead signatories on the letter were all appointees of Republican former President Donald Trump, including U.S. Circuit Judge James Ho, who was with the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and Elizabeth Branch of the 11th Circuit, who previously urged judges to similarly boycott hiring clerks from Yale and Stanford following disruptions of events at those law schools with conservative speakers. Apparently, only about 5% of Columbia's law school graduating class last year went into clerkships, which is in stark contrast to schools like University of Chicago, Yale, and Stanford law schools, where at least 20% of their 2023 graduates sought federal clerkships. With fewer than 4% of law school graduates nationwide getting jobs with federal judges. So what's interesting is that there have been a number of federal court judges who have been asked for their opinion about this since the beginning of the week. And while there are some that are aligned with what these judges are doing, there are a lot of them that are not necessarily aligned either. And at the end of the day, federal judges generally have wide latitude in clerk hiring. And, you know, in that respect, people think that the boycott letter wasn't egregious. Personally, though, Rich, I think that it was really inappropriate for these judges to send this letter. It's just further evidence of the politicization of judges in the judicial branch.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was embarrassing or wrong or any of the words you used to describe it. I think it was the right move. I mean, there's so much anti-Israel sentiment and anti-Semitism wrapped up in these protests that, and even if they went to a little too far, I think it's okay. Someone's got to speak up for the other side. No one's speaking up for Israel. No one's speaking up, hardly anyone's speaking up for the Jewish state. I think these, you know, protesters are cowards and, you know, they're wearing masks and they're not showing their face. You know, listen, I respect protests. I respect people who disagree. Show your face. I mean, you know, there's facial recognition technology that's being employed so that people in the private sector, not judges, can decide not to employ these people. That's just what these judges are doing. They're doing the same thing that private sector employers are doing. They don't want people who are engaged in this type of violent, anti-Semitic protest to work for them. So I don't think there's any problem with it. Like you said, they're not violating any ethical rules. The judges are allowed to decide who to employ. And the fact that Colombia is so permissively allowing these ridiculous protests to take place on campus, disrupting campus life, means they should pay the price. You know, they should pay the price, and they should be known as a school that allows this to happen. And their graduates and alums should be affected by it the same way they're being affected in the private sector by enrollment being down at all these universities that are allowing this to happen. It's just a nature of the market that if I'm a parent, I have a child at NYU where this is all happening. I don't want to spend my money on a university where you can't go to school safely. You can't walk into a building safely, that your life is in danger because you're a Jew. It's crazy. So I think it's totally appropriate. I respect what they did.
Rich, I agree with most of what you said, but I agree with Tina about this letter. I think the letter was a mistake for the judges. The judges have every right not to hire these people, but they're federal judges. And I think it was a mistake for them to issue this letter as judges. I also think it's a fairly poorly written letter, but that's kind of besides the point. I don't think they should have weighed into it in such a public manner. And I noticed that yesterday I read an article, Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm is going to refuse to hire protesters. They're going to look very closely into it and they may refuse. So I think these kids have a lot more to worry about from the law firms than they do from the judges. And again,
well, you don't have a problem with the law firm, though, right?
I mean, too. What?
Well, why do you not have a problem with the law firm doing it versus
the law firm isn't a judge. The federal judges shouldn't weigh into the politics of it, as Tina said. I just think it's inappropriate for judges. And judges may be ruling on lawsuits that come out of this. And that betrays a prejudice on their side. It's a mistake for judges to weigh in like this, I think, in such a public manner.
Sam?
Let me make clear, Rich, that what I said has everything to do with what is appropriate for judges. And it has nothing to do. I mean, I am not anti-Semitic. So I just want to make sure that with the characterization you had after what I said, I'm married to a Jewish man. I'm part Jewish. So, you know, let the record reflect.
Breaking news.
I'm going to take this in a different direction.
This avows anti-Semitism.
Yeah, let me take this in a different direction. Let me pivot from anti-Semitism. And the three of you all said the same word, protest. Who decides the difference between protest and riot? Is there like an executioner on that? You know, the biggest risk, one of my favorite moments on Legal Face Off is
I was going to say, I knew you were going that way.
We had the Reverend Jesse Jackson on the show. And I started by saying that there was a riot because there was a riot. And remember, he made us stop filming and recording. And he said, that wasn't a riot. That was a peaceful presentation. And I said, windows were shattered. Fires were started. Policemen were injured. That is not a protest. So we go to Colombia now and it's, oh, the protesters this, the protesters that. They broke into a building and caused chaos. That's not a protest. That's my big takeaway from the whole thing.
Great shout out to a former guest in studio, by the way, the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
With the Canadian tuxedo. Remember?
Wow, we said it at the same time. We literally remember the Canadian tuxedo concurrently.
And Sam, by the way, that's an argument that we have in newsrooms across the country every time something comes up. How do we label this?
But who decides whether it's a protest or a riot?
The person with the loudest voice is the person who decides.
I think when you're chasing Jewish kids around campus, it ceases to become a peaceful protest. Maybe that's just me.
We've got hip-hop beef. Toronto's Drake, LA's Kendrick Lamar taking diss tracks to a whole new level. But this one involves allegations of underage girls. This has some R. Kelly, Michael Jackson vibes going on.
Yeah, Ryan. So it wasn't always this way between Drake and Kendrick. Over a decade ago, they were actually collaborating on a few songs, but that didn't last very long. Starting in 2013, Kendrick started calling out fellow rappers, including Drake, in Big Sean's song Control. Those lyrics were interesting. He said, "I got love for you all, but I'm trying to murder you. Trying to make sure your core fans never heard of you." And actually, against the backdrop of what's been happening recently, those are some of the more innocuous lyrics. Drake swiftly responded back then, in a Billboard cover story and at the 2013 Black Entertainment Television Hip Hop Awards. So over the next few years after 2013, they continued to spar, but there was nothing big. But in recent weeks, this sparring is culminating to be one of the biggest beefs in recent hip hop history. And actually, since the last week in March, they've been engaging in some fast and furious lyrical tit for tat, with Kendrick accusing Drake of being a predator, among other things. Over this past weekend, there were 6 songs released between the two of them over a 72-hour period, where they proceeded to attack family members on both sides, and there were claims of abuse of women on both sides, as Ryan, you were alluding to. This all culminated in a security guard being shot outside of Drake's Toronto mansion earlier this week, with officials not knowing for sure whether the shooting was related to the sparring. Drake's taken a major hit on social media, with a lot of people making fun of and criticizing him. And in the court of public opinion, many would say that Drake is on the losing end of all of this. From a legal aspect, this war is not without legal issues. There have been some who have speculated, for example, that Drake may be able to at least consider filing a defamation claim against Kendrick. Given his fame, that's a higher standard. And we've covered that on Legal Face-Off before, that actual malice as a public figure needs to be established, and that can be pretty tough. There's also some copyright issues, which we've also covered here on Legal Face-Off, with respect to at least some of these songs, with AI approximations of folks like Tupac in the song Taylor Made, which actually led Tupac's estate to make Drake take the record down. So, Rich, hopefully no one gets hurt at the end of the day with this sparring, but it definitely has had high entertainment value.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, these rap beefs are bigger than ever. My son is a big hip hop and rap guy, so he keeps me posted on them. But I think, I don't know, Sam, I think the opposite of credibility and credentials in the hip hop world is filing a defamation lawsuit, right? I mean, you got a rap beef. The whole essence of that is you settle it either in the music or, as allegedly in this case, you take it, you know, to the streets. But I think once you hire the expensive lawyers, you no longer have credibility in the rap beef game.
That's the whole point. It's supposed to be dirty. It's supposed to be ugly. It's a rap battle. And Drake, let's be honest, is losing the rap battle. So if he's going to hold that final right hook, Sussler, to go to court, he looks like an even bigger dork than he is right now.
Well, I have to admit that rap battles are not my area of expertise. I do agree with you there, Sammy. This one, the music beef that this reminded me of, the one that I know best, is Neil Young and his song Southern Man versus Lynyrd Skynyrd and Sweet Home Alabama. Dylan certainly wrote his fair share of songs trashing people, but the victims weren't really widely known in public. But songs like Idiot Wind, It's a Wonder You Still Know How to Breathe, or my favorite is Positively 4th Street, I Wish That for 1 Minute You Could Stand Inside My Shoes, You'd See What a Drag It Is to Be You. I mean, those are great lyrics. Those are the music beefs I know of.
So we can blame it all on Bob Dylan and this whole sort of trash talking each other in music lyrics, huh?
Yeah.
I'm a little nervous that there might be some issues between Canada and the U.S. as this all kind of plays out. We'll see how this all goes. Well, another story of judges behaving badly. This one was caught in a narcotics trafficking investigation. Tina, what do we know about this story?
So, Ryan, a New York judge recently decided to leave the bench, but it's not your typical resignation. So Mitchell Soules Jr., who served as a justice of the Little Falls Town Court, left his position. You know, interestingly, he's not a lawyer. He left his position shortly after pleading guilty to drug dealing charges. He was arrested last summer, according to the State Commission on Judicial Conduct, in a cocaine trafficking investigation, and was later suspended from his duties. He officially resigned last month after a 3-month investigation by the state police violent gang and narcotics enforcement team. He pled guilty, and you know, it's crazy. So he pled guilty to one felony count of third degree sale of a controlled substance. And as part of his agreement with the commission, he's agreed that he's never going to seek or accept an appointment to a judicial office again. So, I mean, Rich, I guess this guy is being sentenced at the end of the month. I mean, part of, like, we've been talking a lot about judges in this show. I think one of the prerequisites and job requirements is that you're not guilty of things like drug trafficking. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, that's the kind of thing you want to stay away from.
I mean, at least he pled guilty, you know, at least he realized the evidence was probably pretty strong. He wasn't, it's notable that he is not an attorney, this Mitchell Stoles Jr. He was a justice in the Little Falls Town Court. So, not great. Not sure what else, what other commentary you could have on it, but Sam?
I need more details. That's what I want. I mean, we get that he's selling little bags or is he selling bricks? Like I saw the title, Crack Judge, and I thought, all right, this is gonna be good. And then I read the story and I Googled the guy's name and I could not, for the life of me, find how much he was selling. Are we talking street crime or are we talking Tony Montana? Or is it probably somewhere in the middle?
I don't really have much to add other than I want to know what took him so long to plead guilty and leave the bench.
All right. Well, South Dakota's governor, who is said to be on Donald Trump's short list for VP, Old Yellered her own dog. Yes, I'm making it a verb. Rich, you want to throw this story in for us?
Yeah, I mean, she wrote a book, No Going Back, in which she admitted, among many other crazy allegations or revelations, including that she had dinner with the North Korean leader, which then she had to retract. It was interesting knowing that she wrote a book called No Going Back, and then she had to go back on many of the things she lied about in this book. That's problem number one. But yeah, the now most famous dog in America, the former dog Cricket, the now deceased dog Cricket, unfortunately. She admitted, as we all know now, to shooting the dog because he was nipping at people. She later said he was biting her kid. That's not what she wrote. She wrote he was only nipping at people and that he was untrainable, even though she didn't really try to train him very much. And he was trying to, you know, eat her chickens on the farm. So I took a deep dive, and perhaps we'll cover this with an animal rights expert in the next show. But I took a deep dive into some of the laws surrounding animal cruelty and whether she could be prosecuted. You know, this happened allegedly 20 years ago. So the South Dakota Attorney General, who happens to be employed by this person, of course, came out and said, you know, it's now 20 years later, the 7-year statute of limitations prevents us from prosecuting. There's some South Dakota state law that covers dog licenses and regulations. Yeah, at the end of the day, most experts conclude that she did not commit a crime. To be prosecuted, Tina, under animal cruelty laws, seems like you have to be doing it for the purposes of cruelty. In other words, she's alleging that she shot the dog in the head, by the way, because he was a danger to her kids and to the chickens, which actually in South Dakota is a problem with poultry. If she just shot the dog because she was cruel, then that would be a crime. But the way she alleges it, that would not be a crime. Too bad, though, because I'd love to see her put behind bars for what is a disgusting, disgusting thing to do.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rich. It is a disgusting thing to do, and I think it says a lot about her character. But I think at the end of the day, between the South Dakota laws, as well as how cruelty to animals is defined, I'm not so sure you're going to get her on that, because they're going to look at how she killed the dog. And I don't know if there's any evidence that the dog suffered while she, you know, I'm being nice when I say she euthanized the dog. I don't think there's any evidence that there was any suffering, that it looks like it was probably an immediate death. And so I'm not sure you can really get her on animal cruelty either.
Yeah, it's a sad story. I don't think there's much to do legally there with her either. I think the more interesting part of the story for me now is watching her try to walk it backwards and not walk it backwards, like being questions about did you meet with the leader of North Korea. I've met with many world leaders. That's all she will answer now. But I'm not going to get into my conversations with world leaders. And it's just very interesting that that's kind of all she will say about it now. So she won't admit, she won't deny, but she took it out of the book after she recorded it.
Sam, she also said she shot her goat because it smelled. Newsflash, Governor, goats smell. They eat feces, for Christ's sake. I mean, is that a reason to shoot a poor billy goat?
No, don't get ferrets either, lady, because they're not great pets. Let's just save you from that trauma. It's so funny, though, and Rich, you said it, I think, so far the best, is that the book is called No Going Back, yet she's got her finger stuck on the rewind button. And I would hate to be the PR person, especially after the tweet that she made on April 26th when she said, sadly enough, we had to put down three horses a few weeks ago, too. And it's like, stop talking. Now you've killed a dog. You've killed horses. Who knows what else she's killed. But then somebody got in her ear and said, hey, you might want to tweet something else. Tweet this. And then 2 days later, she tweets, well, South Dakota law states that dogs who attack and kill livestock can be put down. So finally, somebody got in her ear after she went on this tweet rampage, basically saying, we love animals, but this happens all the time. And oh, by the way, we just killed three horses. Like, shut up. Shut up.
I had a friend in law school who had pet ferrets. They're not really good pets.
They also don't smell good.
Well, no. What does she do with the people in her life who smell? Is she going to shoot them too?
And just to clarify, she Old Yellered the dog. She didn't Cruella de Vil the dog, as far as we know. So those are two separate things. If she shows up in a mink coat, maybe we've got another storyline here to go off of. All right, moving along. Tom Brady got roasted this week. Rich, it sounds like comedian Jeff Ross went a little too far with TB12 on one of his jokes.
Well, you know, we're trying to cover this from a legal perspective, of course, and the joke that allegedly set off Tom Brady. It depends on who you believe. Jeff Ross has come out and said that what Tom Brady said in his ear wasn't something that made him it didn't sound like he was upset, but yeah, he was joking about Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, being arrested in 2019, Sam, I think, for in a massage ring in Florida. Prosecutors later dropped that case. And that's what set off Tom Brady. It wasn't all the jokes about him leaving his pregnant wife or Gisele Bündchen, you know, hooking up with a jujitsu star that pissed him off. It was this rather innocuous throwaway line with Robert Kraft. That shows you where Tom Brady's loyalties lie, I guess. But from a legal perspective, that was the one joke. And then I don't think there are any other legal related roasts on the Tom Brady one. Perhaps, again, him leaving his pregnant wife was considered out of bounds. But I thought it was a great roast. I don't know if you saw it, Tina, but it was hilarious.
Well, to me, it just demonstrates that Tom Brady doesn't really have much of a sense of humor. You know, I mean, I'm not a big Tom Brady fan. And, you know, the fact that, you know, when you look back at his history, I'm sure, you know, trying to be generous, we all have things in our past that we probably wish we could have done differently. But I don't think he's shown any remorse for the personal side of his life, where, you know, which has impacted a lot of people. And the one thing that he reacts to is, you know, is football related. So anyway, what can you do?
Yeah, I agree with Tina. You know, it's interesting. The article we read about this tried to bring in the legal angle of Robert Kraft's indictment and the illegality of the warrants. And I don't know. I'm not a criminal lawyer, but that to me just goes to the money. You know, money influences everything. So,
damn, you're in Tom Brady's adopted hometown. How was it received there?
They loved it out here. And I think we're going to soon get the ratings. I didn't see the amount of viewers and eyeballs that it had, at least live. It was a 3-hour roast because Kevin Hart wouldn't shut the hell up between roasts. Like, don't get me started on Kevin Hart. But I think it brought back this ability to laugh at some raunchy stuff. I mean, there were a lot of lines that I think weren't just crossed. They were blown over or steamrolled over. And I mean, the joke about, you know, Drew Bledsoe, even he got a ring. Aaron Hernandez had a ring around his neck. Like, that's a funny joke. And enough time has passed. I mean, they definitely stretched the borders of this roast. And I do think it's interesting, though, of all the jokes, I mean, all the Giselle stuff, all the Brady stuff, the insinuations that he plays for the other team, wink, wink, all the stuff they said about Brady, he didn't even care until Jeff Ross made the joke about the massage parlor. And then Brady got out of his chair and said, don't say that bleep again. That, to me, of all the jokes, was not even top 10 that were like bad. Right. It was just, it was very weird that of all the negativity and all the haymakers that were thrown at Brady and his family, luckily his kids were held out. Nikki Glaser said she had a joke about Brady and his son that she didn't say, which is good. Never want to involve the kids. But that was not the joke I thought. Like, if you would have told me after the fact, there's one joke that Brady gets really upset about, this wouldn't even be in the top 10.
Did they do any crypto jokes?
Yeah, they
lost $30 million in crypto. I haven't seen
it. Oh my God. That was the best joke. Oh, I don't want to ruin it for you, but it was the best joke of the night, bar none. Nikki Glaser talking about the crypto thing and bringing in Gronk, but I couldn't do it justice. You got to listen to it. But it was the reason, Sam, that you couldn't see Brady being upset about the rest of the jokes because his face didn't move from all the Botox and the surgery he's had. You couldn't tell if he was upset or happy because his face has been so injected. But we will leave our show talking about Tom Brady. How about I want to talk about our favorite quarterbacks of all time? How about that? You can't say Tom Brady, of course, but Ryan, favorite QB of all time. We know that the Bears have a brand new quarterback that will be a lot of people's favorite here, we hope. Caleb Williams. What favorite quarterback of all time? Non-Tom Brady answer.
Oh, bad here in Chicago. So bad.
Ryan Burrow passing for another week in
pass,
a row for a consecutive show.
Ryan Burrow. Well, I guess Joe Burrow. How about Joe Burrow?
Wow. Pulls out a Joe Burrow at the 1 yard line. Awesome. Tina, favorite quarterback of all time.
I loved Jim McMahon. I mean, it was just the time. At least I was a kid. I thought he was awesome.
Legendary Jimmy Mack. David Sussler, favorite quarterback, not named Tom Brady of all time.
Montana. Joe Montana.
The former GOATs. Last GOAT before. Former GOATs.
Yep.
Sam.
I loved watching John Elway. That guy had a freaking rocket, man. And I thought, you know, getting the Super Bowls at the end of his career were really nice. They went back to back, I think 97 and 98. He was a star in the 80s and could have won multiple more. That guy was a stud. And then least favorite quarterback in terms of covering, Jay Cutler was just a total jag. Like to have to stand across from Jay Cutler in a locker room was hell on earth.
I'm surprised you mentioned Doug Flutie.
Too little, Tina. Too little.
Too small. John Elway, also speaking of Christy Noem, also almost shot by Christy Noem because she thought he was a horse. my answer is, of course, Warren Moon, because he won 5 Grey Cups in the CFL with the Eskimos, who, by the way, is no longer called the Eskimos. That's now a derogatory term. And then went on to fame and glory in the NFL, although he never won a Super Bowl ring. So Warren Moon's my guy forever.
Typical CFL injection.
CFL all the way, man. Let's go.
All right. Well, that'll do it. Thank you so much, Sam Panionovich, David Sussler. And that'll do it for the latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. Special thanks to Northwestern Law Professor Max Schazenbach, UCLA Gender Studies Professor Juliette Williams, and Tiffany Chappelle Ingram, Executive Director of the Cannabis Business Association of Illinois. Also, shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stegall. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Breaux. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...